Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
If you stop learning, there's something wrong with you.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 226 with Mathematics. Mathematics, or Ala Mathematics, is a DJ and producer who has been part of the Wu-Tang Clan since before there was a Wu-Tang Clan. He DJed for GZA in the early 1990s, back when the rapper was known as The Genius. At the same time, Mathematics kept seeing a young rapper named Rakim around town. That guy Rakim would soon become the RZA and would assemble an all-star team of MCs to form one of the most influential rap groups of all time. Mathematics has DJed for almost all of the Wu-Tang members at different points, as well as spin-off groups like Red and Meth. But starting in the mid-1990s, he really made his mark as a producer. Mathematics produced some of the best-loved songs from Wu-related projects, including Mighty Healthy, Cobra Clutch, Wu Banga 101, and more. He also designed the crew's famous logo. In recent years, he's been heavily involved with group albums like Iron Flag and A Better Tomorrow. All of this culminated in Mathematics' new album, Wu-Tang The Saga Continues. The record features contributions from almost every member of the clan and is executive produced by RZA himself. We met up with Mathematics in Midtown Manhattan. If you like The Cipher, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Every new patron helps bring Josh a little closer to buying out Martin Shkreli. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. And now, here's the man who invented that W you're always throwing up, Mathematics. I wanted to start with something that really struck me about you. You often talk about you met GZA at this time, and then you knew RZA when you ran into him on a video shoot. But one time you said where you actually first saw RZA was at Parliament.
Yeah.
The 5% Nation holds gatherings called Universal Parliaments, often in public spaces like city parks, to learn and discuss organizational business.
So I wanted to just ask you about your involvement in the Nation.
For me, it started very young age. It was first presented to me by one of my brothers. I was probably, like, it was first presented to me in the 70s. And I remember my brother giving me, he didn't really explain too much. He was just like, hey, he gets like, you got to choose a name. So I was like, okay. I said Keon. He started laughing. But the reason why I said Keon, because I had just seen The Warriors, and the guy in there was Keon.
His name was actually Cleon. In the film, he's the leader of the Warriors and is framed for the murder of Cyrus, a powerful gang leader who was organizing a rally to bring a truce among the gangs. Cyrus's character and the rally is based on our episode 114 guest Benji Melendez and the Ho Avenue peace meeting he arranged.
He shot Cyrus!
He made you crazy. I didn't do nothing.
We saw him!
Yeah, that's him.
He's the one! Yeah. He's the one! The Warriors did it! The Warriors did it! The Warriors!
That's the one. They actually killed him in the beginning, but I just thought he was a cool dude. You know, I was like, I like the name. Like, it sounded strong. So he's like, nah, that's not a righteous name. You got to choose another name. So he gave me a name. He gave me the name Shaquem at the time and gave me some alphabets and a few things to go over.
One is knowledge. Two is wisdom. Three is understanding. The devil's underhanded.
To learn more about the Nation of Gods and Earth, Supreme Alphabet, Supreme Mathematics, and pretty much everything else about the group, listen to episode 151 with Ala B.
I went over them, but I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was presented to me again when I was in junior high school. And I kind of took to it, but I didn't really take to it like that. It wasn't until I was probably about 15 that I actually really started getting a grasp of it and understanding what it was dealing with to a degree, because it's still like it's food And sometimes a lot of people get misconceptions of the food because when you first get it, you see it and you think it's saying one thing. But then when you really get into the depth of it, because it deals with knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. So knowledge is the first part that you get. It's the knowledge. It's there for you. But it's the same way, I guess, that if you equate it to Adam and Eve in the garden, you know, and they had the tree of life and they bit from the fruit, which was the knowledge. And once they bit that, the knowledge, like they didn't have a care in the world. But once they bit that apple, then they said they felt shame. They started feeling, you know, they started noticing different things and everything changed. So when you first get the knowledge, you see the words, you take it for what they say. But then comes wisdom. Wisdom is the second factor. So wisdom is when they say, you know, wise man, what makes him wise is his knowledge. And how do you know he's wise? Because sometimes a wise man will let you or teach you things without even saying things. So wisdom is more or less, the way I see it, is something that's manifest, that's mm-hmm. shown. You show you have wisdom. You show your knowledge. And the only way you could show it is by the third part, which is understanding. So it takes time to get that understanding. So when I, like I said, when it was first presented to me, then when I first accepted it, and then when I finally, and I'm still going through it to this day. I mean, life is a lesson. You're always learning. You never stop learning. If you stop learning, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
It's like you're in a stuck state. It's like knowledge is infinite. It goes on and on and on.
We had Ala B, who runs the Harlem School, on the show.
Yeah.
And he told us how the father used to spend long minutes breaking down the word helicopter. just one word.
The father is the founder of the Nation of Gods and Earths, Clarence Smith. He was known as Clarence 13X during his time in the Nation of Islam, but within the 5% Nation, as the group he founded was originally known, he was referred to as Allah or the Father.
Yeah, I was attracted to it. It was a lot of people, a lot of brothers from Southside Queens that was getting it. You know, we call it knowledge itself because the first thing you learn about it is tries to teach you. I ain't gonna say try, it does. It teach you about yourself because you applying what you learn to yourself. And it's an old saying, to know thyself is to know all men. Because you know what you would do, but you know what you wouldn't do. And at the same time, you know what other men might do. So, but my involvement with like, once I got and grasped it, I live it to this day. You grow, you develop, and you understand a lot more. And you realize that everything, that's just the foundation. That's all that is. It's like, welcome.
Right.
You know, some people act like that's all it is. No, it's life beyond that.
And so you would see RZA, or I don't know what name he was going by then.
Rakim. Yeah.
At some parliaments. Were they in Harlem or were they in?
Well, Harlem, uptown at the Harriet Tubman School.
P.S. 154 Harriet Tubman Elementary School has for years hosted the group's annual Show and Prove event. It's just around the corner from their headquarters, the Allah School in Mecca.
They used to have them. I think they just started having them again at Mount Morris Park in the summertime. Like there was certain times to be at Mount Morris Park and certain times to be in Brooklyn at Fort Greene Park. So, I would see them then. And this is way before music, you know what I mean? So we had a common thing within the nation as far as building. And even like, you know, back then I used to drink 40 ounces. He did too. So we used to drink, you know what I mean? Which is a way I met a lot of brothers. Just like, just going through, you know, mathematics and having a drink and just going, you know, just having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I originally met RZA.
Mm-hmm. At what point did you take the name Allah Mathematics?
I took that name years later. I changed my name a couple of times. Like I said, my brother first was like Shaquem. Then I changed it to Supreme. Mm-hmm. And I was DJ Supreme Cutmaster. And I think I changed my name to Supreme in like 86, 87.
There was another Supreme in your neighborhood around that time.
Yeah, from Supreme Team.
When you hear talk of the South Side, you hear talk of the team. You niggas fair prints and respected prints.
Kenneth Supreme McGriff was the head of the Southside Queens' notorious Supreme Team crew. At the late 80s peak, the gang was making $200,000 a day from crack cocaine. McGriff was eventually convicted of racketeering, two murder-for-hire homicides, narcotics trafficking, and engaging in illegal financial transactions with drug money. He is currently serving life in prison.
Did you know him?
I didn't know him, but I knew who he was. I did certain things for certain people within it. You know, maybe he commissioned it, maybe he didn't. But for certain people within his crew, I DJed certain events for, whether it was a basketball tournament or, you know, a jam in the park they was having in honor of somebody. Mm-hmm. So I did that for individuals. Now, some of them I did know. Him, I didn't know like that. He was a person that he was from what I seen of him. He was real. He was always quiet, cool, calm.
Yeah.
But he wasn't easy to get to.
Within the past maybe 10, 15 years, people started talking about the Supreme Team in that era of Queens a little more. And there's been books, and some of it's been fictionalized in movies.
Many men wish death upon me. Blood in my dog and I can't see.
You can read about the Supreme Team in Ethan Brown's excellent 2005 book, Queens Reign Supreme, Fat Cat, 50 Cent, and the Rise of the Hip Hop Hustler. There is a fictionalized version of the relationship between Supreme, 50 Cent, and Ja Rule, one that is unsurprisingly highly favorable to 50, in 50's biopic Get Rich or Die Trying from that same year.
What were your impressions of the Supreme Team when you were growing up?
Oh, well, Supreme Team, it's like, growing up, it's like, you know, it was a mystique about, like, because you knew dudes, like, I did park jams. So doing the park jams, like, you know, you knew a lot of dudes that worked, that was workers that worked for certain other individuals. And then, like I said, I was commissioned by some of the bigger dudes, and I kind of looked up to them because it's like, you know, they would pay me to DJ, to do what I do.
Yeah.
Not only that, it's like they make sure you ate. It's like, you want something to drink? What you need? You know what I mean? And then they did things for the community, and I know, like, a couple of them cats, I remember, like, you know, certain brothers, like, they might only wear their sneakers one time. And then what they'll do is, They're selling probably for like $5 to somebody, like to a younger, like, yo, you got five, yeah, you got, you know, take these or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, what size are you? So, you know, it wasn't like, you know, they was like all bad. You know what I mean? They did what they did.
Sure.
And I get, you know, once you're in that business, I guess you have to enforce on competition or somebody else trying to threaten you. So, you know, I know they did what they did, but, you know, you had time, even like, you know, I lived in 40 Projects, too. Mm-hmm. And that was Fat Cat. Mm. And Grandmaster Vic is from 40 Projects. And he's actually the one that I saw that made me want to become a DJ. And you had, you know, Fat Cat and Pappy and them cats over there.
Lorenzo Fat Cat Nichols and Howard Pappy Mason were the leaders of a gang called the Bebos that was allied with the Supreme Team. Grandmaster Vic is an influential Queens DJ who began his career in 1977. In addition to making a name for himself with live appearances, he was also arguably the first person to create blends, mixing a cappella tracks with different instrumentals on mixtapes.
I could tell you stories about them as far as like paying people's rents, buying groceries for you know, some of the older folks, or taking a whole neighborhood to great adventures.
Mm.
You know, like, come on, renting a bus, get the bus, everybody get on, I got you. You know, taking the whole hood, yeah. So, you know, they did things like that. Now, you know, nowadays, I don't know drug dealers that do that or nothing. I haven't heard of nothing like that in years. But the drug game ain't the same no more anyway. But I guess it's a fascination because it was a good time, but it was a bad time too.
Yeah.
You know, it was a good time for hip hop. Because there was a lot going on as far as hip-hop. And like I said, I DJed a lot of centers, block parties, and park jams, you know, based on off of what they was doing. Seeing the good of it, but you see the bad of it. You see the fiends, people in your neighborhood turned out. People's parents, like some
this
of my
was
friends'
87,
parents.
88, you were DJing, which is the real height of the crack era.
Yeah, yeah.
You're playing a park jam or a dance or something, 87, 88. What records are you playing?
Eric B and Rakim, like that album, Slick Rick was bubbling at that time. Then you had a whole bunch of dudes that, you know, people probably don't really remember, but they should go look up, like Taylor Rock, Ultramagnetic MCs, and Rap's New Generation, and, you know, Teddy Riley. I was up on Teddy Riley for a long time because he produced the show for Slick Rick and Dougie Fresh, and then he did Rap's New Generation. Get him, get him.
Excuse me, Dougie Fresh.
Yes!
Have you ever seen a show with fellas on the mic with 1 minute rhymes that don't come out right? They bite.
They never write. miscellaneous.
When I heard that, I was like, yo, that right there used to kill the Pogs. BDP, when they, and I'm from Queens. So as a DJ from Queens, like even when we played like The Bridge Is Over, all the Queens DJs did it, trust me. Then they get to the part, Manhattan keeps on making
it. Manhattan keeps on making it. Brooklyn keeps on taking it. Bronx keeps creating it. And Queens keeps on faking it.
Be like, Manhattan.
Fade out right there.
No, not fade out. We used to play tricks with the words. Like, Manhattan keeps on faking it. Brooklyn keeps on faking it. Bronx keeps on faking it. Then you spin it back. Queens keeps creating it.
Oh.
And then here's... It's like you could never play that part. Never play that part. You always had to do that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's a great trick. I can imagine that happening.
MC Shan, The Bridge.
The Bridge. The Bridge. The Bridge. The Bridge. The Bridge.
Hip-hop. Anything from the Juice Crew was rocking. I remember when Kane first came out, because Kane first came out around that time, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, G-Rap, it's a demo.
It's a demo. It's a demo. People in the audience, Gucci Rap is my name. I write rhymes and assert them inside the brain. And DJ Polo, the man up behind, he operates some turntables when I rock my rhymes. It's a demo.
I was playing stuff like that. And then the breakbeats. You know, we still in the breakbeats. The MC's coming and grabbing a mic. So we was rocking like Impeach the President, Substitution, Scorpio, and I Can't Stop. Stuff.
All the greats.
Yeah. Mardi Gras. Take me to the Mardi Gras.
Oh, wow.
Nautilus. You know, a lot of stuff people be sampling nowadays.
How did you first hook up with GZA? You met him a little bit after that period, like 90 or so, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because GZA used to live in Queens. You know, GZA lived all over New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And I always heard about GZA, like, you know, like who actually I call him my brother. He is my brother. He ended up, you know, being with my sister. Like they've been together, you know, as long as I can remember now. His name is Infinite. And he was the one who actually got me right as far as mathematics, you know, because my brothers didn't do what they were supposed to do. You know, neither one of them, you know, but my other brother actually... When I wanted to become a DJ, Dasheem, he was the one who actually got me my turntables. I got a pair, like, when I seen Grandmaster Vic, you know, I've been to Park Jams before, but it was this particular one, and this was in 86,
mm-hmm.
and I finally made it to the front of the ropes, you know what I mean? And I'm looking, I'm just watching how he was just so graceful with it, and I was like, that's what I want to do. So I was trying to save up my money, and I bought me a little Gemini turntable. My brother came over. He seen it and he laughed. He's like, what's that? It's like, it's a turntable. He's like, that ain't a turntable. So he's like, that's what you want to do? I said, yeah, that's what I want to do. He said, all right. He left. You know, he was into other things, you know. So he left. He came back. When he came back, you know, he had his cool brain. They brought in a coffin for me with two Technique. They were B1s. It wasn't 1200s, but it was B1s with a mixer. And they set it up for me and everything in the room. And he was like, you know, if this is what you're going to do, do this. Don't do what I do. Do this. And that's what I did. And it's like, I remember he came to me. He was like, yo, mommy was like, yo, what? Why you give him that? What you doing to him? Because he don't come out the room. It's like he stays in the room. And she didn't know I was cutting school, staying and practicing. But
right. But
doing that, that's how I got down with a crew. And that's how I started jamming in the park.
Right.
You know, I was 15 years old, jamming in the park.
So DJing was really your thing for a long time, before beat making.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So that's how I ran into, you know, to answer your question, because
You know, you heard this guy was a good rapper.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, his name is Law Justice. So I would hear AJ this. I'm like, well, where AJ at? Because he had already moved out, you know. But I knew his family. I knew his family life. I his aunt, I called her Aunt Betty. You know what I mean? That's how, you know what I mean? So Infinite finally hooked us up together, and we hooked up, and he seen I got busy, and I heard him. I was like, he dope, so I became his DJ, and yeah.
And the Cold Chillin', what was it, the Blizzard Tour?
Yep, Cold Chillin' Blizzard Tour.
What was that like?
That was beautiful, because it was like, I'm actually on tour with dudes that I idolized,
right.
You know what I mean? Like G-Rap, he's still my top five, one of my favorite MCs, you know what I mean? Right. So... Like, when I heard Road to the Riches and it's a demo and all that, like, Rikers Island, I was hooked from there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was like, wow, I'm on tour with Coogee Rap and Polo. I'm on tour with Master Ace, Biz Markie. You know, I'm on tour with these dudes. Kane is popping in and out. Granddaddy IU, who was just kind of new, but he was dope. Yeah. Kid Capri was on that tour. And it was great. But it just didn't balance out the way you thought it would, because you like, oh, we made it.
Right.
Like, big time.
Right.
You know, he's getting per diem. I think he's getting, what, maybe like $35 a day. Came back home.
Big time.
Yeah, came back. Yeah, big time. Came back home broke. I remember I borrowed money from my pops. It's like, you know, to get some clothes to go on the road.
Mm.
And, I was like, you know, I made sure I saved up enough per diem to pay him back his money. Mm. Like, you know what I mean? But, yeah.
Wow. I know that your life changed in that you had to get a job after the Cold Chillin' thing ended.
Yeah.
I make the mic pump, my mic makes the party jump. Poison beats make hip-hop a stump. The feet kind of wild, they give all spark. But I still light it up when the place is pitch dark.
GZA only released one album on Cold Chillin', 1991's Words from the Genius. After the record flopped, he asked for and received a release from the label.
How did it affect your mind state when that happened?
Well, it kind of messes with you a little bit because, you know, I look back at it now. It's like I laid up in a bed for a long time, you know what I mean? And my pop seen it, you know what I mean? And me and GZA was talking and talk about next moves and, like, you know, trying to do something. And we actually, after I got the job, because my pops was like, you know what, come with me. You know, and I changed my name to Mathematics probably in 91.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think 91 or 92.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I changed my name to Mathematics. It was Shamik Supreme, God of Law, at that time. And I said, you know, and it was during that time that I was messed up going, you know, just going through it when I, you know, I was like, let me get to myself. And I remember just staying in the house for maybe like about 2 weeks and just doing a lot of studying and figuring myself out. And I said, you know what, I'm going to take it back to the foundation that all things come from Allah's mathematics. And that's what I chose to call myself. And then after that, you know, I came back outside. I was able to stick my chest out because I felt better about myself. And then Pops, he seen I was trying to do something. But he seen at the same time I was still a little, you know, he's like, you know what, come with me. I went with him to work. I remember the first 2 weeks, I was going to quit because I was like, you know.
Going from tour life to manual labor, right?
Yeah. You know, became a carpenter. And he's a carpenter by trade. You know, he walked me in, got me in. And, you know, first 2 weeks, I was going to quit. And I said, I'm going to stick it out just because it's Pop. And he brought me in and let me do that until I got my first check. When I got my first check, I said, you know what? I can do this. I can do this. And me and GZA was still talking. And then, he was like, yo, we need to do some joints. So I was like, all right. So what I did, I bought a Kai 950,
mm-hmm.
HR Alesis to trigger it.
The Akai S950 sampler, introduced in 1988, was the company's first model to implement time stretching, meaning you could make a sample longer or shorter without changing the pitch. The Alesis HR16 is a drum machine from the same period.
I guess I was producing then.
Mm-hmm.
Started, you know, but I was just doing straight samples.
All right.
You know, just putting some drums to them. And we did a couple of joints. We did a couple of little demos, and we was going to my man Todd crib because he had the studio.
You still got those anywhere? Can I hear them?
I wish I did. I think Infinite might have them. Mm-hmm. I got to check.
Okay, please
I got
to
check. I think Infinite might have them. But what happened, RZA was talking about doing this, you know, the whole Wu thing, mm-hmm. And RZA was already killing the beats. And then when I started hearing, you know, what he was doing and how everything was going, I was like, well, what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know what I mean? Like, I'd rather DJ at that point. I wasn't really into the production like that at that time. Yeah, so I back to DJ.
You're DJing for these guys on the road. You see RZA gather everyone into what would become the group. Was there ever a point at which they said, okay, it is a group, it's consisting of these guys, and we're called the Wu-Tang Clan? Was there ever a particular moment like that?
Well, probably, because I know what RZA was doing. RZA was, going around. Like, I was meeting these guys going out checking RZA. You know, like, you know, go through, check RZA out. Even before I started working with my pops, I remember we would go out to Staten Island, just chill with RZA for, you know, while he was making these beats. And you know, I didn't have, you know, the money like that at the time. So sometimes we used to have to hop on the train, we used to go to the store, steal 40 ounces, stick them in our pants. There's the baggy pants into the Timberland boot era, you know. So we used to put the 40s in the pants and walk out the store. You know what I mean? Walk to the subway, hop on the train. We used to get out, you know, for free. Go out, you know, get out there for free.
Yeah.
Hop on the ferry, get off the ferry, hop in the cab, tell the cab the address, get out the cab, don't pay. And then we'd be stuck out there because cabs wouldn't. We have to tell them different addresses because they wouldn't go.
They wouldn't go back to the address. They ripped you off.
Yeah, no, they would. Yeah, they wouldn't come pick us up from there. Or if you said you was going there, after a while, they was like, "No, I'm not going there." It's like we already know. Yeah, so you know, I remember the first time I met Meth and Deck. They came over to RZA crib. First thing Meth was like, "Yo, you want to smoke?" you know, I knew Ghost and Ray already because they used to roll with RZA a lot, you know, so them brothers I knew already, and they used to come to some of the shows when we had cold chilling joints, you know. Killer, I knew Dirty, of course. Dirty used to, you know, I knew Dirty, you know, for a minute, and Killer, because Jizza brought Killer around, and Jizza brought Killer Priest around too, so I knew them brothers. But what RZA was doing, he was getting all the MCs and signing them, like he, you know, Meth would tell you he's Wu brother number one, he's the first one to sign. So when RZA formed Wu-Tang, he formed Wu-Tang Productions, and he started gathering these MCs.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, RZA was on his game back then. He's seen a lot before all of us. I didn't really see his vision like that, but he used to say things, and then you start seeing it start coming to fruition. He was like, whoa, hold on. It's like, you know, you got, yeah. So that's and everybody's seen that. That's why brothers trusted RZA for so much, for so long, because RZA say something to make it happen.
Right, and he had already by that point had the Tommy Boy deal.
Hear all about RZA's pre-Wu-Tang record deal with Tommy Boy Records on episode 171 with Monica Lynch.
But he already had the fat beats. He already had, you know, everybody was coming to his crib doing joints anyway.
Right. You also were involved in other elements of hip-hop other than DJing. I know you used to dance a little bit.
I used to break.
Rock and break. Were you better at going up or going down?
I think I was a better break dancer.
Mm.
Like, my name was Kid Float until...
Kid Float?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Until there was another Kid Float, and he got popular on 98.7 Kiss, so I changed my name to Float Master because I used to do the float.
Mm.
And I used to break from floats and the windmills back into floats and do all types of different floats. Like, yeah, so I called myself Float Master. Yeah.
And graffiti, when did that kind of come in?
Oh, graffiti came in early because I was, you know, well, I guess breaking did too, because up rocking was first because it was b-boying.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to the center, and the first dude I seen it was a dude named Rodney McLean, and he was doing a b-boy. And I thought, you know, I was like, oh, that looked mad cool. So I started trying to imitate that. Graffiti, you know, always been around. Plus, I could draw. My older brothers used to draw, you know, so I used to chase behind them trying to draw. And then I got down with Cruz. I started doing graffiti, got down with Cruz. And
What did you write?
Well, I started, it seemed like every time I come with a name, somebody else come with it and they get bigger. You know, back in them days.
Right.
I guess because I was a young shorty doing it and everybody was maybe a little older than me. But I started off writing. It was a dude in my school. He tagged Too Nasty. So I said, I'm going to tag Too Nice. Yeah, I thought that was dope. Then another Too Nice came.
Aww.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So then I had a couple of names. I went to Faye. Then I went to G-Ster, G-S-T-E-R. I never eclipsed like a lot of brothers did. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But I did my share.
Yeah.
You know, I did it. I think I did enough. And RZA knew I did graffiti, so... You know, when he was on Tommy Boy, I did his original stickers for him, which was Wu-Tang stickers.
Right, because I know he had that name pretty early. You said that it was just kind of a slang word
that
he
would use slang
before
that,
it was associated with, like, specific people.
Yeah, because it's like when he wanted his stickers done, and he was like, yo, I want him to say Wu-Tang. I thought he would want his name on it. I was like, Wu-Tang? But I was like, yo, that's dope, because I love karate flicks, too.
Right.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I thought that was dope, and I knew on the island they was already using Wu-Tang as, like, a slang, and I think RZA started it. You know, like, it was dope. Like, yo, that's Wu-Tang. It's Wu-Tang. So Wu-Tang became the thing. So I did his stickers, and then when we was talking about, you know, formulating... You know, the Wu-Tang crew. and you know, always talk about doing something to stick out, symbols or a certain design. I came, you know, we shortened up the Wu-Tang from the whole name to a W, and RZA was already thinking Protect Your Neck before Protect Your Neck was even done. Mm. He's like, yo, gotta teach these niggas to protect their necks, man. Like do something with the neck, with the head cut off. So I drew a W holding, with the hand coming out, holding the head with dreads and the neck with the blood.
Was, yeah. And that was that on the original Protect Your Neck single?
No. We never used it. Yeah, it was a little too graphic. So the original logo was the W inside the book with the sword underneath.
You can see both of Mathematics' original drawings at thecyphershow.com.
And we took the sword was something I put underneath of the Wu-Tang stickers. They had Wu-Tang, put the Wu-Tang sword there. RZA was like, well, let's apply the book to it because you got wisdom, book, and the sword with the tongue. And we had that discussion the night when he called me, came from work, and he called me at the house. You know, there was no cell phones then. He called me. He was like, yo, I need a logo. I need it tomorrow, though. Getting these joints print up, I need the logo. So I was like, damn, tomorrow? I bet. So I went, got me a cold 40-ounce of Old English 800. Got me a Philly blunt, got me some trees from 121 and stuffing, chocolate tie, rolled it up, smoked it, drunk that, got to work on my black book. Next day, RZA, Power, Ghost, and Devon came to my job, and I had it for them.
Mm. Looking back now, over 25 years later, what is it like to see that symbol become so iconic?
It's crazy. It's still a little surreal. You know what I mean? It's like at times I recognize it like, yo, oh shit, I did that. But for the most part, it's just like, I don't know. It's like, it still ain't really settled in yet that it is so big. It surprises me because I never had the idea that it would be this big.
Right.
That people would have it tattooed on them in shirts and baby onesies. And I have no
I've
idea.
Seen the baby onesies. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
In addition to music, which I'll get to in a second, you did a bunch of other things, one of which was a DVD where you interviewed a bunch of producers.
Yeah, Beat King.
Got my first dose. Hip hop from the Jizzle back when I was 7 years old. I found myself actually running home from school, grammar school, working on a beat.
So I was curious, what led to that? Was there some kind of questions you wanted answered for yourself?
Well, it was just something, it was an idea. I wanted to kind of step out and do something different, but it's like you had all types of things about the MCs at that time. And back then, it wasn't really a lot of producers. It was, but it wasn't producers that was really out there like that, like how producers are now. So I said, you know what? Let me have a producer to producer talk. Because I would get interviewed, you know, about being a producer, but they wouldn't ask the right questions or certain things. I know I can pluck the heads of a producer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how that came about. And then, you know, he's still my dude, Ari Jabron, and you know, they kind of got me on it because when we did the deal, I remember we did the deal, right? I got the deal for it. And I remember I was just on the road, and I remember the guy who I did the deal with, it was Devin Horowitz of Nature Sound. He called me. He was like, yo, you cool with the artwork and everything? I said, yeah, I'm cool with it. He said, you know, because I wasn't paying attention. He said, you sure? I said, yeah, I'm cool with it. Let it rock. So then after it was all done and I finally seen the final package, I seen what he was talking about because they labeled themselves executive producers and all that, and they didn't even give me the title.
The cover of the Beat Kings DVD gives Mathematics credit for, quote, interviews and score, while writing, producing, and created by credits went to other people.
So I was like, oh, so I said, you know what, that's never going to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I'm make sure anything I deal with and I'm dealing with it, you know, I'm going to make sure I get my credit because credit is important in this business.
Of course.
That's
yeah.
why and anybody I'm dealing with, I would give them their credit because it's just due.
Yeah. So you start making beats for Sirius mid-90s.
Yeah, 95 is when I actually started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Fast Life, I think, was
my first
track. One of the first ones to really make it within the Wu-Tang camp.
Yo. Wally Champ, so amazing. The suede shoelace up in the Sheraton. Just got hit for 5 years probation. I got a dental appointment at 2.
Why do you think that one made the cut? I assume you'd played them a lot of music before Fast Life was chosen.
Well, let me, like back then too, right? The process of making a Wu album, right? It had to be fire. And it's like they'll take you through it. So it's been, you know, you had Fourth Disciple, you had True Master, and they've been producing. I just started producing. It's like what made me want to produce then, because like I said, like before I was just sampling, but when RZA was working on Cuban Links and he did the Ice Cream track. I got a chance to really see it from beginning to end and really hear it. And it's like, I've been in the studio and I've been around him making beats before, but for some reason, this particular night, it just stuck out. And when he finished that beat and I heard it, I remember going to him like, yo, what's that? He was like, yo, it's the ASR-10. Gave me a quick crash course on it. I went and cop one right after that.
On guard. I'll let you try my Wu-Tang style.
Bring the motherfucking ruckus! Bring the motherfucking ruckus!
The Insonic ASR-10 was a sampling keyboard produced between 1992 and 1998. Here's RZA talking about it.
But in 1991, going to 92, Insonic put out the ASR-10. And when they did that, that's when I became a master producer. The whole first 100 Wu-Tang songs was made on the ASR-10.
I started producing. So now when you know, he's always in the studio, you get the call to come to the studio. Every time I get there, True Master's there. Fourth Disciple's already there. Inspector Deck, because he's a dope producer too. And they playing these beats. And I'm like, no matter how early I tried to get there, True Master out of everybody will always be there. Always. This particular time, I got there first. I got there first. And by that time, and then, you know, it made you really work on your beats, because when you hear what they playing, it's like, yo, I gotta work. I got to get right, you know?
Yeah.
So it made me work harder. So when I came through with that, you know, and I remember I was in the studio and I was playing some joints, and Ricky Waters was in there, Andre Rison, who else is there? Hakim from Madism, mm-hmm. What we do? Yeah, I remember they was up in there, and I remember that's the first time I really had people really, really feeling my tracks like that. So I'm like, okay, I'm getting it. And Andre Rison and Ghost wanted the Fast Life. They wanted that beat. So I got that. But Ricky Waters, True Master, still came off because he did the other joint with Meth and Ricky Waters.
Pull your shoes up, don't get stuck, or get your frame struck. When my squad blitzing, hitting like Mack trucks, head splitting, paper written, and windy cities like Chicago, no bullshit. You see me spitting.
But I got it. You know, I was glad I worked my way in, because before that, I actually did one track before that because it was different. I don't even know the title of it. And I forgot the group. But it was some type of jungle group or something in London or something I did a remix for. I got the record somewhere.
So when you're making music, right, do you create it these days or even back then with a specific project in mind, with a specific artist in mind? This is for Wu Massacre, or this is for Killer Bees Army or whatever. Do you make music for particular projects, or is it just sort of you make a bunch of stuff and then it ends up where it ends up?
Well, you do it all. It's like certain things it might cause for a project. It's like the joints I did for A Better Tomorrow, I made those specifically for A Better Tomorrow because I understood what RZA was trying to get across.
Mathematics produced two songs on the Wu-Tang Clan's 2014 album, A Better Tomorrow.
I seen how he was coming with the music, so mm-hmm. I did my music to fit in with that for Better Tomorrow. Certain things, like if I know I got to do a track, like if Ghost would be like, yo, I need a track, I know what Ghost like. I'm a chef up something for Ghost. Then if I'm doing, you know, I make music on a regular, and music for me is emotional. So it depends how I feel. So, you know, I don't always, it's not never really the same process. I do different processes. I might start from the drums. I might start from a bass line, you know, however I'm feeling. But as the music is coming, I'm hearing, I hear Meth on it. I hear, you know, you start hearing it. You know, sometimes you just know it's dope, and you know, anybody could really murder it. Or you might make something that that you like, but you're not sure other people like it. So you put that in your private folder and be like, you know, right. I'll get back to it. Maybe one day people might appreciate that. But right now, I don't think nobody want to hear that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Are there elements, like specific elements that need to be in a beat for it to sound like something that would be in the Wu-Tang universe? Like, are there particular musical things? Does a hi-hat pattern need to be a certain way, or a snare need to sound a certain way, or...
Yeah, no, because it's like you have, all right, for instance, right? Let me see. I mean, you know, when you come to boom bap, it's always that. Or. So
something resembling that should be in there.
Yeah, but then not necessarily either, because it's like you can have just the one. So then it depends on the sounds. I think it's a certain frequency, maybe. And drum patterns, too. I mean, you know, it's just like Wu-Tang hits hard. Even when it's not hitting hard, if it's something like America is Dying Slowly, it's still that boom, you know, it's still that soul to it, or, you know.
You fall in the manhole. Where the forbidden tree go and boost your ego, a fly negro, a garden sour, polluted with a dead flower. And months later, he's laying on the respirator.
So, I guess so. For me, it's hard to explain, I guess, because I make the music. I've been doing it for so long. And I just express myself and how I'm feeling. But, I experiment. And there's certain things that, you know, we have experiment with.
Well, Theodore is a pretty fucking strange song.
Which one?
Theodore, the ghost track.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it's almost like a lullaby-esque piano, and that's basically all there is in the whole song.
Yeah. Stark edition, rock Christians, the crystallized rock. Got them big jewelry dealers on a mission with a slick taste of ways that it smack New York City. The 450 went popping when he tried to jip me.
Were you surprised when Ghost picked that?
Nah, because sometimes we do abstract things or some, you know. You know, sometimes, but it still had the drums too. You know what I mean? And there's certain sounds that just hit chords or, you know, strike certain nerves. And it's like just the sound of them. Like, you know, I believe it's been a long time, but I want to say it was the harpsichord that was used on that. Yeah, harpsichord. Yeah, yeah. Kind of like tweaked with the bells with it. You know what I mean? I would have to listen to it again because I made that so long ago. But it was just like, you know, it's like sometimes certain things. But I knew that was Ghost when I made that one. I was like, yeah.
One of your favorite beats of yours, mine, the guy over that way, everyone, is Cobra Clutch.
Yeah, moccasin money, one man behind a plate, holding down honey, Shalal rock the half man Gumby.
What do you remember about making that?
Oh, I was mad too when I met Cobra Clutch. I remember I just left the East Coast and I went to the West Coast. And, it was a situation at home. And, you know, when I got out to Cali, it was just like, it felt good, but I still had something boiling in me. And I just remember, like, I need to make a beat just to get, you know, release. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Cobra Clutch was his birth. And it's just like, even with the screams, when I added the screams in, because that's how I was feeling. I was like, you know what I mean? So it was like, I threw those in it. And then when that came out, it was just like one of them beats.
You know, I have to ask also about Wu Banger 101, obviously another crowd favorite. Long time, one that has stood the test of time.
Plastic, see the logo, a monument in hip hop, carved out in a giant landscape of broken rocks, where the herd and nerve spots, jukebox and most shops, uncut live, drop 85 in one shot, spotlight.
What are your memories of making that?
I made that one really around the same time as Cobra Clutch, actually. It's like around that time I remember like Cobra Clutch, Wu Banger 101, Mighty Healthy.
Shake that body, party that body. Don't fuck with ghosts and feel sorry. That's word, I'm not the herb. Understand what I'm saying, saying.
It was all made in that same time span. And I made Wu Banger 101 back on the East Coast. I was back on the East Coast when I did that one.
Listening to a bunch of your work, some of the stylistic things that stand out to me are your use of vocal samples and strings.
And I'm fly, Malachi eyes on standby. The Y chromosome with the X, I multiply, yo.
Seem to be two things running through your catalog. Can you talk about each of those, where your inspiration came from and using them, how you use them, how you got good at using them?
Voices, when we was first sampling, sometimes you have a banging sample, voice was in there, so we left it. You just leave it. It's like, it sounds fat anyway, so you leave it. But like I said, Cobra Clutch was one of the first joints where I actually added them in, because I was already so in love with them. Just hearing, like, when you had, you know, certain things. It's like, even like a joint like Lesson Learned, but I made that one from scratch.
But you went and got a singer to essentially recreate something that
right.
People would sound like you chopped up a
pre-existing
song.
Exactly. Yeah.
Niggas in the streets gon' learn. Them Staten Island niggas don't play.
I said 1, 2, 3 into the foe. I glide like it's simply no traction on the flow. 103 or 4. Live action from the door. Shorty down.
And it makes for, you know, when you hear that, you know what I mean? It's like, and then the strings, you said strings. I love strings. I always love strings. I thought one of my favorite producers is Curtis Mayfield. And the way he uses strings always is, you know, like his bass lines and his strings, I always love it. And his harps. I mean, he's all his instruments, he uses Elway. Strings bring, you know, you can use it to for drama, you can use it for climaxes, or you can use it, you know, strings can be chilling, they can be, you know, they set the mood, or it could just relax you, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love strings, I love vocals, and I love bass lines, too.
The stuff now, the stuff on the Saga Continues, where you had people sing what sound like vocal samples. Do you ever have people coming to you and say, oh, I can't believe you used that record, and they're so sure what record it came from?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I did a Q&A.
Do you ever disabuse them of that?
Yeah, I did a Q&A, and a guy was like, told me he thought, like, Lesson Learned, but one of my favorite producers is David Porter.
David Porter is a producer, songwriter, and singer best known for his time as staff songwriter at Stax Records. Working with Isaac Hayes, he wrote and produced hits for Sam and Dave, Rufus Thomas, The Emotions, Johnny Taylor, The Soul Children, and countless others. He was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2005.
He thought it was a David, he's like, you know, he thought it was
an Isaac Hayes, David Porter thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, nah. I said, I'll tell you what, you find that sample, you come back and let me know. You know? So, yeah. But it let me know I did my job, because, you know, it sound like that. I got the sound I wanted. You know?
Yeah. The Saga Continues stuff. The thing about that album that stands out to me, and some of your other work as well, is the sense of arrangement. Some of your stuff obviously is looped, but there is plenty of stuff where even within the loops, you have stuff coming in and out of the mix, or things dropping out, coming back and building and all of that. Where did you get your sense of arrangement from?
Studying music. Like a lot of my favorite producers are like the producers we used to sample from: Norman Whitfield, Stevie Wonder, Curtis Mayfield, Isaac Hayes, David Porter. And they would arrange, like, if you listen, like, Isaac Hayes is, and David Porter, definitely my favorite producers. Gamble and Huff.
To hear more about the architects of the Philly soul sound, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, check out episode 207 with Ron Lawrence.
But the way they arrange their songs, like if you listen to Walk On By, it's like 13 minutes, the full version.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like 13 minutes.
Isaac Hayes' 1969 version of the Burt Bacharach and Hal David song Walk On By is exactly 12 minutes long. It has been sampled over 90 times by everyone from Beyonce to Biggie to MF Doom to Tupac.
Is this paging me at 5:46 in the morning? Crack of dawning, now I'm yawning. Wipe the cold out my eye. See who's this paging me and why?
Turn your lights on, chasing all of the rain away. When you come around, you bring brighter days. She told me, "Whoa."
So much happens, like the way it starts from one point with just the you know, the din 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 din, boom, 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 boom. Then the wah wah comes in, and then, you know, wah, 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 and it's just, you know, so, you know, I studied over the years and I'm like, well, this is how music is supposed to be made. It's supposed to be made with climaxes and drops and changes. And, you know, even if it's something repetitive, because, you know, you want a repetitive phrase in your music, mm-hmm. but you want it to do more, you know. So that's one thing I'm still learning, how to do that and how to make things, you know, opposed to just like making a beat or sampling a loop. And, you know, yeah, I just want to get better with it.
Was this record the first time you'd worked with live instrumentalists? Or no, I guess there was a lot of that in Better Tomorrow as well, right?
Yeah, Better Tomorrow. But the first time I actually did it was I had put out a project called The Answer.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
If everything is cocaine, tell them fiends they want a cop, we don't want change. I'm liking things the way they are, I don't want change. Back in the 80s, had crack babies and gold chains. We played Skelly Walkazellis with the gold frames.
And that was my first time, you know, it was trial and error. I tried to do it without samples in that one. And, you know, I did it, but it wasn't, you know, like it wasn't like the saga because I learned. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely trial and error. Not saying that it's not dope. I thought it was dope, but, you know, I could see the progression. And by the time I got to the Better Tomorrow, it definitely helped me. So I think it might have been wiser to do The Answer and hold on to it until I perfected it or got better, mm-hmm. you know. But, you know, you live and you learn.
Yeah. There's an oddity in one of the Wu-Tang songs you did, the Do You Really song.
Okay.
Has kind of a coda at the end where it's a separate beat.
The left, nigga.
I got this, man.
Get
the job, nigga.
Where the fuck you going?
Set the fuck up, dick
face. Right, is that you too?
Oh, Do You Really?
Yeah. The end section, is that you also?
Yeah. That right there, I'm going to leave that one out there.
Okay. It's a mystery.
I'll leave that one as a mystery.
Okay, sounds good.
But yeah.
Sounds good.
And one more thing too, like even my first two albums, like The Problem and mm-hmm. Love Hella Right, I'm getting ready to re-release those.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, you can't find them.
Yeah, I took them
very
down.
Very difficult to find. I found The Answer and the prelude you did to it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. But I took those down. I got mm-hmm. the rights and everything back to them, and I took them down so I can remix and remaster them, and then play them over and do you know so. Yeah. They sound a lot better, and I should be dropping those soon too.
Nice. You did a lot of stuff with Red and Meth as a team, both live, obviously DJing mm-hmm. for them, and on both Blackout Records.
I'm high powered, the dog Rockwaller, chocolate tie showers, got that cooking minute rice for 5 hours.
Yes, sir.
In the air, two hot boys that put coke in your ear. Fuck him.
What makes a Red and Meth beat? Because I think it to my ears, is a very different feel than
Wu-Tang.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a different feel. It's more funk. Red and Meth is more funk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's I ain't gonna say it's melodic, but it's a melodic to it too. Some of their songs, but it's not the type of melodic like Fourth Disciple's very melodic on some of his joints. Like when you listen to the Killer Army joints, like and he's killing it.
A puff of bone as usual, the suspect can never be. A lie sees everything. A bad boy's silence is the key to longevity. So take his advice, for I reiterate the thought to take your life in the will. Magazines
recover that. But it's kind of different. It's more of a, yeah, it's a funk vibe, and it's more of a fun vibe too, like me dealing with them. But when I bring them into my world, because I also know what they like to rhyme over, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, Red rhymed over Rising to the Top. How you roll a blunt? That's how you roll a blunt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tip the tip, roll it in the motion, then the top piece your lick. Seal it, fry it with your lighter if you got to. The results, proper.
Killing it, and that's Rise at the Top. That was a Southside Queens anthem at one point, you know. Doom 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 doom. So yeah, it's like you got to look at the project. Who else is on the project? What they bring to the table. You want to stand out, but you want to be able to fit in too.
Yeah, and what is it like DJing for their live shows? I know those guys can get pretty wild.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm used to it. I've been rocking with them since 95, since the show tour,
right,
and the Month of the Man tour. It's like they went back to back, and after that we've been rocking together ever since.
You did a documentary, you were going to at one point, I saw a trailer for it, and I don't know if it was or finished, about sort of the music business in crisis, the music business in transition.
A lot of artists have to switch who they are, and then they get caught up, and then they can't go back because people are already used to what the label has made.
Was that ever finished?
Never finished. I think I should finish it though. I was doing it from a different angle. I said, let me go into like, and you know, at the time music was changing, the internet. Like, I went and interviewed Ujamaa. Like, it's a booking agency and it's a black booking agency. And they was booking like Lil Wayne and, you know, Big Thomas and all of them. And they was the first ones where I heard about Drake. Because Drake wasn't signed. It's like, yo, we booking this kid Drake. And, you know, he's getting big, you know, he was getting big through the internet. Mm-hmm. And he got a following and we book his shows and people come and he sells out. And, you know, so, you know, now look at Drake, right? You know what I'm saying? So yeah, that's why it's like, it's kind of funny that, you know, I'm going to interview Burt Podell, but, you know, for those who don't know, he's, big time accountant. You know, he started out with Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio. And he had everybody from then since, I mean, he had Prince. He had, you know, like, you know, Rakim. He had, you know, this big spectrum. Like, you know, so I went and interviewed him just on the money part. I interviewed, you know, different A&Rs and behind the scenes people. Just, you know, but nah, it never came out. Mm-hmm. I never finished it. Never came out.
Any plans to finish it down the line?
I think so, because I would, you know, I got that footage and I still got the footage. Mm-hmm. You would just see the difference in, you know, the film.
Right.
You
know, cameras have changed a bit.
Yeah, they changed.
You know, you've had maybe 4 weeks or so to live with the idea of another album in the Wu-Tang history books being yours. How does it feel now you've had a little time to digest it?
Well, I'm still running around walking, so it's, I don't think I digest it like that. Yeah, but it feels good when the album finally released. It felt great because you know, I know you probably already heard, like I had alienated myself from music, so I wasn't listening to nothing except for what I was working on.
Yeah.
So anytime the, you know, the kids get in the car with me, I'm putting in what I'm working on. So they was hearing the songs over and over again. I remember like one of my sons, he was like, Frozen is his favorite. He loved that song.
In the rain. I don't sweat money. Neck chisel to frost. Make money, maintain and build me a train. Rolling Buddha, ice cooler, gray goose and a big Ruger. Most of us popping pain, selling drugs in the rain.
But he was like, he asked me, like, this was like last year, like, did it come out yet? Did it come out yet? I was like, nah, it ain't come out yet. He said, not yet. I said, nah. I said, believe me, when it come out, you're going to know it. So I told him, so when it came out, I said, yo, you remember when I told you that? He said, yeah, I do. I said, nah, see, you know it. Because I didn't want it to be like the answer. You know, I mean, you know, you know, like I did that project and it, you know, Nobody knew it, but I tried to do everything myself.
Mm-hmm. And that was a solo album specifically.
Yeah, that's like a solo album specifically. Yeah.
DJ Mathematics album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still, you know, you would wanted people to go get it. And, you know, because I have people get the problem and they got, you know, Love Hella Right.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just tried to do everything myself on the answer.
Mm.
And that wasn't the answer. You know, to me, it's still a great album, but it's just, you know,
yeah.
I learned a lot since then.
Right. And you obviously got RZA, you know, executive producing this, I think.
Yeah.
What role did he play in kind of shaping the record?
He played the artist role.
Mm-hmm.
He came in as an artist when it was time to be in the studio. You know, and at the time, I was such in a passion and such in a drive of doing what I was doing. I didn't even recognize it. But, you know, because I'm working and while I work in the studio, I'm working. I don't, you know. It's like, you know, I smoke my trees and all that. But when it's time to work, because I smoke before I get there or before we start.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'm working. And when I'm working, I'm in work mode. And who's ever in there got to be in work mode. And he came in. He took direction when needed. If I was like, nah, that's not the verse, change it. He ain't have no problems doing it. He didn't try to change nothing. He ain't try to alter nothing. He ain't even give me no suggestions while we was in the studio working. Now, I didn't pay no attention until we was doing an interview later, and he was
then
like,
"You're thinking back on it,
yeah?" Because he's like, "Because somebody was like asking RZA, like, how hard was it to be on this project in the studio and not take over?"
Yeah,
and he's like, "Well, you know, he actually said he didn't have a problem with it at the time." And I had to think about it. It's like, "Yeah, you actually came in and you know and didn't you know what I mean didn't
right.
try to change nothing or you know he did what was asked of him."
Yeah.
So on the artist part, he played his part as an executive part. He played his part too, you know, as far as like help, you know, as far as the business and making sure everything go right and setting everything up. You know, he's a professional, and that's one thing that you know I'm learning from him as of right now too about the business,
because mm-hmm.
I've been in the business for many years, but now I'm learning show up on time, be prepared. You know, it's been times I wasn't prepared, you know, even doing the show sometimes. It's like, I ain't got all the instrumentals with me. We can't do that song. It's on my hard drive. Where's your hard drive? Oh, it's in the lab. I left in the hotel room. I don't do that no more.
Hmm.
And so it's like, you know, I learned how to be a professional or better professional dealing with RZA. But a big part he did play, and it was, you know, sometimes they say the little things mean so much. When the album was finished and I was listening to it, I was like, the album is dope, but it's just something about it that's not really helping to take it where it really needs to be, and I can't put my finger on it. I think I was burned out from listening to it so much, trying to perfect it. So I called him. I was like, yo, Abby, it's finished, but it's not. I was like, I need your ear. So we went to the Wu Mansion, went in the studio, put it up on the big speakers, and he had a notebook. He had the pad, you know, yellow pad, and got the pen, and he was sitting over there, and I'm sitting right here at the board.
Mm-hmm.
So I started playing it, you know. So I glanced over one time, I see him writing, and I said, you know, I ain't even gonna look. I said, let me just vibe out. So I'm vibing, listen to the whole album, and when we finished, he passed me the notes. He's like, nah, this is what I think, and I'm thinking I'm gonna get like a whole bunch of shit back. I was ready to turn pages and everything, but it was like a paragraph. And it was like some songs that he, you know, I looked at it. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, you know, so I took it back to the lab, made those changes. Now, all the changes, it was only one change that I didn't do. Because, you know, when I tried it, I was like, mm-hmm. nah.
Do you want to say what that was?
Nah, I ain't
okay.
Want to do that.
But
it was a good suggestion, but it just didn't, I think it didn't work. It's just that I think, you know, one part of it worked, one part of it didn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That
so
makes sense.
Yeah. So, but it opened up. But them little changes helped create the album we have now.
Yeah.
It made it. After I did that, I was happy. I was like, oh yeah, that's good.
How did the Sean P verse happen?
Yo, you ever been face fucked with the 4/5, sweating facial expressions, stressing like, oh shit, that's the shit that I don't like. Non-rapping rappers in the booth and they don't write. Fucking stupid ass rappers acting out of their character. I shoot and stab rappers.
Sean P verse happened during The Answer. He was originally doing that for me for The Answer album. And I wasn't in the room, you know, because we ran into each other, you know, we run into each other all the time. And I remember we ran into each other overseas, and he was like, yo, we got to do something like authentic, straight up from, you know, for real, for real. I was like, yeah, for real, for real. And so we was talking from there. And then Phantom, Gustavo.
Gustavo Phantom Guerra is a longtime DJ, A&R man, record executive, and manager who has worked with Wu-Tang, Tragedy Khadafi, Large Professor, 40 Cal, and A-Rap Music, among others.
He actually got us to link up, and we talked, and I was like, yo, let's do this. So I sent him a track, and, you know, he did the track for me. But by the time I got it back, I had just mixed and mastered the answer. So I was like, damn. I was like, you know, it was a dope verse. But I was like, you know, the album is done. I didn't tell him that. So I said, you know what? I put it on a remix. I do a remix for it and put it on a remix. I never did the remix. So when I started working on the album and I really started working on, like, the music, Sean Price always been one of my favorite MCs. So what I did, I was like, yo, I'm going to still use this verse because it's fire. But what I saw, I stripped the beat down and just left the snare, right? So he's rhyming over the snare. Then I changed the snare. So when I changed the snare, it had a new feel. So then I started making the music around that, around Sean Price verse. So when I made the music, it was like, I said, yo, this is banging. I said, yeah. And then when everybody started hearing it, just like, you know, when RZA got on it, we was on the road. And we was on a bus. I was set up on a bus. RZA did his verse on a tour bus. Then when we was overseas, I booked a session in Germany, and Ghost came, and, you know, everybody else came. Ghost took to that right away. Then Meth had already got on it too, a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
So Meth, we was on the road. I was on the road with Meth, and Meth heard it, and Meth was like, yo, I gotta get on that. So that's how that one came together. So before Sean Price died, right? He's overseas in Amsterdam. You know, I was on tour, Red and Meth. We had the night off this particular night, and we was in Amsterdam, and Boot Camp Click was there performing. So me, Street Life, and a couple of us went to the show, watching the show from the side of the stage. Like Sean Price, you know, the brothers seen us. They came over, gave dap. Sean Price came over, gave me dap. He was kicking it. And I was like, yo, because I knew he was saying to himself, like, yo, I did that verse, he didn't even use it.
Right.
You know what I mean? So when I seen him, I said, yo, I got something I want you to hear. He's like, oh, yeah. I said, yeah. I said, you're going to love this when you hear it. He's like, yeah. I said, trust me. But that night, we never hooked up. And unfortunately, I never seen him again. You know, when I found out he passed, I was like, damn, I really wanted him to hear that. So he never even got a chance to hear it. He didn't hear the beat when I changed it. You know, I know he would have loved it.
And, you know, on a sort of similar note about someone now gone from us, you said you've known Dirty, you know, you knew him a very long time. What's your favorite memory of him?
You know, I was talking about Old Dirty today, earlier, because I had a dream about Old Dirty a couple of nights ago. The dream was, you know, me and RZA was running around, you know, because we was doing all this promo since the album came out, and Dirty actually met us somewhere. So we was going to the studio. We ended up going to the studio. We was hanging and everything. And it was like, you know, we was talking. And I remember it was just like he came back from somewhere. You know, I mean, you know how dreams is. Mm-hmm. Like he was just away or something. He back.
Right.
And
didn't
I remember,
seem weird or anything.
Not at the time. And most of the time he's in my dream, I know he's not here physically anymore. So when he do pop up in my dream, because he does, you know what I mean? And when he does, I know, oh, I'm dreaming. It's like, yo, come on, let's hang out. And we just hang out. We have a ball in my dream. But for this one time, I didn't realize that it was a dream. And you know, I was all caught up. And I was like, yo, it's good to have you back. He's like, yo, it's good to be back. I remember gave him a pound and all that. And we were supposed to be hooking up later. And then I woke up. And I woke up, I was like, wow. But, you know, his birthday's coming up, as well as the day that he did leave us physically. So I was talking about him earlier today. And I was just saying, like, he was one dude I didn't like to get in the car with, because he was, you know, the saying, all gas, no brakes.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he drove.
Yeah.
He drove like 100 miles per hour on the streets. Know what I mean? So I was just talking about him today. Like, yo, I remember one night he crashed like three cars in one night. In one night. Three cars in one night.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I was talking about, I was driving with him one time. I remember that's when the Navigators first came out. So this is like 98. And we was in California, and I was like, oh, this is dope. That's what made me, I went and got a Navigator after that. I was like, yo, this is banging. And I remember he hit somebody. He was driving, right? Yo, he was driving, and he's speeding down the streets, and somebody came running out in front of him, and I don't know what they was thought. They got caught. Bow. Rolled over the hood. Boom, 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 boom. But they hit the ground, got up, and kept running. And we just looked at each other. It was me, Dirty RZA, and somebody else is in the car. But I just remember us, we all looked at each other. It's like, yeah. It started cracking up. It's like, go, go, go. Keep going. Because he just kept running. We ain't know why. He's like, somebody chasing him? We ain't see nobody chasing him or nothing. It's like, yeah, so that was crazy, you know?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That is something.
Yeah, rest in peace, old Dirty. Miss that, brother. Yeah. You know?
Obviously, the album's out now. You're still promoting it. What else is going on?
Oh, got something else in the works. I think people really going to love, too. Really going to love. I just don't want to really say it just yet because it's not finished.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather the project be finished than I can say it because then it's like, it's no reason for it to be held back. And I like to do it this way. I prefer to do it than the, you know, because when it hits you, it's going to hit you. But I got something coming, something real nice that Wu fans is going to love this. I guarantee you. And if you're not a Wu fan, you're going to be. If the Saga ain't make you one yet, you're going
to
be.
Well, that sounds like a great note to end on. A lot of mathematics. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
While we haven't had RZA on the show since way back on episode 2, we've had quite a run of tracing the history of the Wu-Tang Clan on this show. From talking about ODB's antics with his right-hand man Buddha Monk, to discussing RZA's Tommy Boy days with Monica Lynch, to hearing about managing the clan from Sophia Chang, we've covered a whole lot about the Shaolin crew over the years. This episode adds to that legacy. Mathematics has played a crucial part in the Wu-Tang saga. Several crucial parts, actually, if you include his visual art, DJing, and production contributions. I hope this episode gave you a sense of all of that. Join us next week when our guest will be Static Selecta. Static is a DJ and producer, and his new album, 8, is out on December 8th. Among the artists making guest appearances are Run the Jewels, Joey Badass, Wale, The Lox, and 2 Chainz. We'll talk about that, his early days in Boston, and much more. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. Make sure you check out our archives when you're there. If you like this episode, you should listen to our interview with a woman who was raised by Wu-Tang, the great Sophia Chang, on episode 176. By the way, if you use Apple's podcast to listen, go now and give us a rating and a review. It's by far the easiest way to help us out, which is why every podcast you listen to wants you to do it. Seriously, go now and do it. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just $1 a month, I'd be able to afford the entire Kill Army discography. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share extra audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. We've had behind-the-scenes production stories, unreleased Wu-Tang, and all sorts of things you can never find anywhere else, even on our regular episodes. Join us by the end of November to have access to December's file. You can find us at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Follow us and let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
He was one dude I didn't like to get in the car with.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
So I went, got me a cold 40-ounce of Old English 800, got me a Philly blunt, got me some trees from 121 and Suffin, chocolate tie, rolled it up, smoked it, drunk that.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Well, this is how music is supposed to be made. It's supposed to be made with climaxes and drops and changes.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Oh, I was 15 years old, jamming in a park.
Audio editing by Rob Van Vranken.
You do it all.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter David Njoku.
So, yo, you want smoke?
And extra special thanks to Teresa Sanders.
Yo, oh shit, I did that.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Black Book. The Black Book.